Spotify.
I was accused by a lot of
Hi, this is this is July 26th, 1977. We are in Corvallis, Oregon, and we're talking to Gary Peters. It's good to see you, and I'm glad we could get together. We always start these interviews with just a series of what will seem very innocuous standard questions. They're not.
February 4, 41.
And where were you born?
Wenatchee, Washington.
And what were your parents doing at the time you were born? Occupation?
My father was an orchardist, had apple orchards, since Wenatchee is the apple capital of the world. Mm-hmm. And my mom was a housewife. Did some work in the... No.
They were, however, active church people.
Yeah, very much so. When I was growing up and when I was at home, we went practically every Sunday. Mm-hmm. And very much so.
Feelings about living or working overseas or being engaged in something like...
Not really, when I was growing up... that more or less came about after I was in college, and then when I met Brenda, we had talked about, after she finished nursing school, we would go somewhere for a couple of years before we had any kids. At that time, the Church of the Brethren was Brethren Volunteer Service, and the only place they had at the time was India, and that would have been like for 3 years. And we got in touch with IVS, and at that time they were taking people to Laos and Vietnam, and they were only taking married couples to Laos, so that's why we ended up in Laos.
We don't want to get too far ahead of us, but because I've interviewed Brenda, we know that largely, probably for the same reasons, you went to Laverne College outside of Los Angeles and rural areas you grew up in.
And my father still talks about that, about all the number of young people that went from Wenatchee down to college at Laverne, because that was quite a drain there at one time. And most of the girls got married and stayed away, moved away. A lot of the guys did too, but he still, in fact, I was up there 2 weeks ago visiting him. He made the comment again about, well, the church in Wenatchee is in sad shape. It's it's dying. All the old folks are dying and not coming back, and there's no young blood, and the church is just going downhill. So,
what about? I mean, as soon as I asked that question, that occurred to me. It hadn't when I was talking to Brenda.
Wenatchee is a pretty rural town. I mean, it's growing tremendously since I lived there. But there's not a whole lot to do in Wenatchee unless you're associated with the apple industry and, clerking in a store or something like that, or doing something along that line. There's not not much in the way of industry. There's a big aluminum company down the river that employs several thousand people. But that's about it. And so a lot of the kids my age, as soon as they got out of high school, head for Seattle. Seattle, Tacoma, that area. That way they go to California. And once they got to California, they saw that it was a big world out there and never came back. So,
well, just in time, they realize they really want to get out of there. And
maybe
Central Washington sounds like a great place.
It's a nice
to
area.
To raise your kids.
It's a nice area.
Yeah, it is. But you were one of those who migrated south. Did you have a sense? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I migrated south. I went to Laverne the 4 years. And then we got married in 64, went out to Riverside. I worked there on a graduate degree for a while, actually 1 year while Brenda went to school.
What did you get your 4-year degree
in? In biology.
And your graduate work was in?
I was in entomology.
And so to make a brief story, a little fuller, when you finished school, when you got married, actually, when you got married, you decided that you would spend a couple of years doing some what? What you had
My registration at that time with
your draft registration?
Selected Service, because of my pacifistic background with the Church of the Brethren, was as a conscientious objector. Now, it never came to the point where I was called and was told I had to do one thing or the other. but I had decided that I did want to do something, and you know, for a couple of years.
Because of the Brethren connection, you knew about IVS.
I knew about BVS first. Mm-hmm. That had been talked up for years and years. Mm-hmm. And Brethren Voluntary Service was strong in India. Mm-hmm. Brethren Church has been sending people. It was for a 3-year. And at that point, I thought 3 years was a little bit long. Mm-hmm. Where I had a choice, it was either between India or Southeast Asia, and I thought Southeast Asia sounded more fun, more interesting. I don't know. I guess I had heard more about India than Southeast Asia. So I probably knew a little more about India. Southeast Asia sounded all new and totally different place, and you know, played in probably 66, probably had been early 67, but it was probably late 66. Mm-hmm. Ivan and Karen Bowman, they were in the unit before us, and they were in education, whereas we were in rural development. Mm-hmm. Over there, like in July, and started writing back letters about how great things is cheap, you can buy all kinds of stuff over there, and IVS, I don't know if you've talked to any other IVSers, but if they were anywhere near a city, they had especially like the capital of Laos, they had very well-stocked liquor cabinets, because you could buy Primo Beer.
You went for a orientation program? Was it Harper's Ferry or just in Washington?
We flew out of Seattle, went back to Washington, D.C. We stayed at the famous Kilpin Hilton, which was this really rundown old hotel somewhere in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I mean, a bathroom. When I first saw those accommodations, I thought, what are we getting into? Because it was pretty shaky. Mm-hmm. I heard later that the regular accommodations were not available, so this was the next worst. In Washington, D.C. for, I don't know, maybe a week, going through a different orientation, maybe not that long. We took the train out to Harper's Ferry. Mm-hmm. And stayed on this big old house on the hill. Three reunions back there at that building.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think of that the orientation?
A lot of it was kind of a blur. Mm-hmm. I remember there were a lot of different speakers that came in, ones that had been over there already, that were giving their ideas and impressions and stories about what to expect, what not to expect. Mm-hmm. The things they told us early on in orientation, that don't go over there with any preconceived notions or ideas or expectations. Mm-hmm. Go over there expecting the worst, or don't, you know, just you're going to be out in a lean-to out in somewhere and no running water, no electricity, no nothing. Just, you know, don't, just go there with a totally open mind and go with it from there. And there were people that went over expecting certain things, and some of them were very disappointed. Mm-hmm. We were very fortunate that we got into an area that had Americans there for years. Mm-hmm. We had 24-hour electricity. We had running water, hot and cold, the whole thing. It was very... We were plantation... I remember John Gardner. He was... I think at that time he was a director of IBS. Mm-hmm. I remember exploring around Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. Interesting town. From the lodge, from the hotel, you could see into three different states. I mean, you were in one, you could see into two others. But that was my first real experience on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. So Washington, D.C. was hot and humid, you know, middle of August. I guess probably the lack of sanitation, the dirty conditions, I know we landed there at the airport, and just, oh, this is kind of different, you know. It's just not primitive, but just way below U.S. standards as far as sanitation like that. Mm-hmm. Got to the IVS area, and things were different. You know, didn't have any real striking, you know, things that hit me. It was just say I was in it for the adventure. I mean, hey, whatever, uh-huh. you know, whatever comes, I can deal with it.
Did they have any language training
for you? We did. We had, I believe it was 6 weeks, and then also writing it. Mm-hmm. Now, when writing it, working on the script and all that, I got some kind of an ear infection. I missed a lot of the work when they were doing the script. Mm-hmm. When we did the first part with the, after a while, you know, I could pick out different things, but it wasn't as intense as the others. It was interesting times because we would have our language training part of the time, and then after a week or so, we would go out and we would spend the night in local homes. And and the first couple of times would be real shaky. You just kind of sit there and look at each other, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Laotians were well aware of what they were getting into. You know, mm-hmm. you may sit there and look at these Americans. They don't speak your language, so, but, you know, try. And that's kind of interesting because, you know, we did get to go out and spend some time. Mm-hmm. Again, we were sent up country where most of the people we worked with had been associated with Americans for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And so they spoke pretty good English. They also spoke, most of them spoke French, Laos dialect, mm-hmm. probably usually several dialects. Most of the time we could get, especially the people we worked with right around Sam Tong itself, mm-hmm. All understood enough English here. Out into the villages with the, I would always have an interpreter with me. Mm-hmm. And the way I've seen it several ways, the mm-hmm. way that, that That's we had funny. It was, you know, capital S-A-M, capital T-H-O-N-G. Looked like Sam Thong, but it's right. It was Sam Thong. Mm-hmm. It was like, I think, around 4,000 feet elevation. Mm-hmm. I kept it, you know, outside the house, well, inside the porch. But the daily high and low temperature the whole time we were there. And mm-hmm. and the hottest it ever got was up in the 85, 86, 87 mm-hmm. capital, which is right along the Mekong River. Mm-hmm. It was hot and humid and sticky most of the time. Again, we were fortunate in that we were in a pretty good climate. Mm-hmm. Let's see, we had our orientation. We got into Laos like the 6th of September, somewhere around that time. And language training up until, I think it was somewhere into December. Mm-hmm. Tong was a very touchy area at the time. Mm-hmm. I don't know what Brenda told you about the area.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
But, you know, Sam Tong was a refugee relief center, and right across the hill was Long Chang, the military thing, where mm-hmm. all the supplies were coming from Thailand. All the CIA folks.
What were they doing?
Fighting the secret war. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were supplying the... There were, you know, C-130s coming all the time directly from Udorn and these bases in Thailand, bringing mm-hmm. them ammunition by the plane loads. Mm-hmm. So we are across the hill in Sam Tong taking out refugee supplies, and just over the hill they're taking out military supplies. So it took like several months before I was allowed to go across the hill to Long Chang. Mm-hmm. And I worked with mm-hmm. who was a legend in his own time, mm-hmm. legend in his own mind, but also you know, mm-hmm. a pretty amazing guy. And so it took him a while to get to know me, to know that I wasn't. One of the things they told us before they sent us to Sam Tong, that whatever you see up there stays up there. Mm-hmm. You don't come back to the down to the city, Vientiane, Chan, and start telling people what's going on up there because things are too touchy. So we were almost, you know, sworn to secrecy, and especially mm-hmm. once we got a chance to get over to Long Chang because mm-hmm. there were all kinds of things going on over there. Mm-hmm. So it took like several months before Pop took me over to Long Chang one day mm-hmm. and took me into ops operation or into the main compound where all the he said, this is Gary, he works for me over at Sam Tong, and I'm going to, you know, give him clearance to come over here. So if you see him over here, you know, without me sometime, don't shoot him. I said, okay, no problem. And they put out working for Pop, and he's okay. He's mm-hmm. been cleared by Pop.
Okay, of course, Pop then was working for USAID.
He was working with USAID. Yeah. He had started out in Laos back in the 60s mm-hmm. and then went to USAID. And physically, he was a little guy, 5 foot five or 5 foot six, mm-hmm. and not real impressive, but he worked. He got right down to the grassroots. He would go out and sleep in the villages and talk with the people and eat with the people and just, you know, get right down with them. And he had the most fractured Lao, but everybody could understand him. You know, he was just, he was out to save the people in the north. Mm-hmm. And
from?
See, the area around Sam Tong was, it was always getting bombed further north. Mm-hmm. Bad guys were trying to come in from China and North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And so they were always overrunning villages. Then you'd have this whole raft of refugees coming down. Mm-hmm. And they would try to resettle somewhere else. And so Sam Tong was the center that was sending out pots and pans and blankets and rice and stuff to get these people through wherever they had stopped, mm-hmm. Wherever they stopped running. They would establish a little area. They may be there a few months. They'd get run out again. They'd keep moving further south. Mm-hmm. And during the rainy season, they would push back, maybe take some of the territory back. Because the rainy season was real messy as far as trails and roads, and it was hard for the enemy to get around. Once the dry season started, enemy activity picked up, refugees got pushed out again. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those villages further north from us were going back and forth, good guys, bad guys, year after year after year. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they had this whole system of most of the areas had either a helicopter pad or a small airstrip. And they had this whole system of signals that some trusted person in the village mm-hmm. had a certain signal. So if a plane would go up there, like especially in the mornings, because you know most of the fighting took place at night or whatever, mm-hmm. some of it did. If you'd fly into an area, that say in the morning, you would circle it until this certain signal appeared mm-hmm. on the ground. Mm-hmm. If it was the right signal, they would land. If it wasn't, they would go on because you know things were constantly changing hands. Mm-hmm. But Pop was into a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you get into the books of over there during that time. He was a good buddy of Tony Poe. I don't know if you've heard of Tony mm-hmm. Poe, but mm-hmm. he was over more in the Ban Hui Sai area mm-hmm. of Laos, and he was into all kinds of things, legal and illegal.
Illegal being what?
Opium trades.
Uh-huh. For what purpose?
Ban Hui Sai area and on over to the, I guess, the eastern part of Laos. Mm-hmm. That was where the pop out.
There was opium trade going on.
There was opium trade going on. The Air America that's out. Mm-hmm. It was, that's part of the thing it was dealing with. You know? So there were a lot of different people involved in that. I don't know to what degree. You know, I can't say for sure that there were a lot of USAID folks that were wearing a lot of different hats over there at the time. It was one of the interesting things working with IVS. I mean, we would get to see all kinds of different groups. Nobody was asking any questions of the other. Mm-hmm. We would, every now and then, we would fly down to Bangkok, and we would get on these military flights. He's sitting there because here, Brenda and I were usually the only couple on there. Mm-hmm. And there'd be all these little groups sitting around, and everybody's talking, everybody's looking at everybody else. And they could not figure out who we were working for. You know, here's this young couple. Who are they working for? They got to be working for CIA or somebody. Now, you know, it was just really weird. Mm-hmm. And when you'd land in Vientiane, well, you'd get to Bangkok, you'd do your thing, you'd come back and be the same situation. You have this plane with all these different groups. Plane lands, taxis to the stop. All these little groups go off to different buildings at the airport. You know, USAID would be over here. CIA go over here. Air America go over here. We'd catch a taxi and go back to the IVS house. Mm-hmm. And really an interesting time. You go to the market in Vientiane, you'd be looking over produce with the North Vietnamese or Patat Lao right there side of you. You'd be looking at the same head of lettuce or same thing, bargaining back and forth, you know, with different things. And but yet 5 miles out of time, they'd shoot you. You know, it would just... The embassy parties, the Russians, the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese, the Patat Lao, they'd all have a big party. Big old embassy party. They're all buddy buddies, patting everybody on the back. Party's over, enemies again. You know, it's just weird situation. And I think it did in that a lot of the things that they were doing, I mean, in southern Laos, not so much as where we were, but in southern Laos, they had a lot of irrigation projects. They would put in these different dams, you know, to irrigate croplands. Mm-hmm. They were doing a lot of well digging, you know, fresh water for the people. Mm-hmm. Where we were, it was pretty hilly, pretty steep. Mm-hmm. So the agriculture that we were doing was growing with hill rice. A little bit of flatland rice, but there weren't that many valleys around. It was pretty steep. So that was another thing. On our way from Washington, D.C., we stopped off in the Philippines for a week and had a week of training at
Los Baños.
At Los Baños, at the International Rice Institute. Out in the rice paddy with the water buffalo and tried to plow, and they kept telling us stories about leeches for this big and all that stuff, and these stories that they were telling us. But that was very interesting, learning about different varieties of rice. And we had bamboo culture, where we'd go out and we'd try and weave baskets. They were telling us all different varieties of bamboo, and that was an interesting time. It was just kind of getting us from Washington, D.C. into the, let's step back a century or two or three, back into Southeast Asia and learn how to weave baskets from bamboo and learn how to plow behind a buffalo. And
you found that useful?
It's fun. I mean, it was interesting. Actually plant rice, you know, stick it down in the old mud down elbow and all this stuff, and just that was wild.
Well, of course, the folk that you were using their own methods.
They've been growing rice for 3,000 years. Right. So here's this young guy from the States. Okay, folks, we're going to tell you how to grow rice. You know, that kind of, you know, that's like Americans going up and selling refrigerators to the Eskimos. Like, you know, here we go. They've got a better idea.
I know there's a butt in there. But you didn't do that.
Yeah. What we did do, I took a seminar. They said don't say butt because that leaves it open. You know, you got to kind of go on around. And, what I would tell people that would ask me the same questions, you know, well, did you do any good over there? I say, well, we showed them there are different ways to do things. Now, whether they use it, that's their choice. But we did show them there were other methods.
What kind of methods were you showing them?
I was an agriculturalist, which covered a lot of things. We did everything from distribute vegetable seeds, because these refuges get run out. They got no seeds to plant anything. Didn't even have any land, have anything. So they'd supply them rice and pots and pans and whatever. And then we'd go in there with different types of vegetables. So they could actually, if they were going to be there long enough, they could actually plant crops. Coal crops and you know, things that they would use. That was one thing we did. We also, since a lot of them were lacking in protein, we had both a duck distribution program and a fish distribution program. They would dig these pits and ponds, and there was a lot of water up there, even though it was mountainous. There was a lot of streams, and so they would divert it down, a lot of rivers and stuff. So they would dig these ponds at various different sizes, and we would provide fish that were kind of like a carp, you know, fairly fast-growing fish. 100 or so in the chon, we'd have to make all our connections. They were in little square boxes with, I don't know how many bags of fish per box. And then we would take it out from there and drop them off at these villages. And they'd have their pond already and dump the fish in. And that was a fish distribution program. The ducks were the same way. We these big old crates of ducks from well, actually probably came in from Thailand. It goes up and distributed around the villages. Those were two things, and then the vegetable thing. But, however, the biggest thing I was involved with was introducing varieties of rice that had grown, that had been developed in the Philippines, that were supposed to grow well in the hillside climate of northern Laos. Most of the rice that we worked with was hill rice. There was some paddy rice. That was also new varieties from the Philippines. There were also a lot of hill varieties. It was interesting the philosophy that the Americans had as far as this rice program. And so there was, okay, there's one area around Sam Tong. They had some valley areas. So we introduced all these new varieties. Well, they went ahead and planted them. And the new varieties were shorter plants, stockier plants, much heavier yielding plants. bigger heads of rice and all this stuff. But I went ahead and harvested it the first year or whatever. And then we started hearing these complaints about, well, with our native rice, we have to bend over to plant it. We have to bend over to weed it. When it grows up to harvest it, it's 3-4 feet high. We can walk along and pick it without having to bend over. Mm-hmm. Your rice, you got to bend over to plant it. You got to bend over to weed it. It's little short stuff. You got to bend over to harvest it. And we don't like the taste of it. Mm-hmm. So the American comeback was, well, you grow your rice during the one part of the year, you know, for your own use. Mm-hmm. Then you grow this new rice and you harvest it and you sell it to Thailand and get money and buy stuff. He said, why? Well, our rice is half of the year for us to live on. Then we want to party the other half. We want to make rice wine. We want to make all this stuff. We want to kick back and relax. We don't need any money. Why do we want us to work the other half of the year to grow rice to send to Thailand? We don't need money. Americans would say, no, that's not the American way. You know, you've got to grow rice, send it out, make money. Why? We're happy.
Who were the Americans telling them that?
USAID, because they were the ones that had the planes that would fly it out. Another thing, we came in with this new variety of rice. Along with that, to make it grow like it does in the Philippines, you got to have fertilizer.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's my next question.
So they'd fly this fertilizer in on USAID Air America planes. Mm-hmm. You would fly in insecticides because you got to keep the bugs off the rice. Demonstration projects were great. Once the fertilizer and the insecticide ran out, that project's over. We can't get any more fertilizer for you. And it's 90 miles of no roads down to the capital. They aren't going to go down there to get that stuff for their rice. They go back to growing their old rice. So there were some great projects, but nobody followed up on them afterwards. It was, you know, like, well, here's these new varieties. So that goes back to the same story. They know there are other ways to do it, but you got to get the stuff to go along to make the whole package deal. You got to get the fertilizer, you got to get the insecticides, you got to get somebody to buy this rice that you don't like to eat, that you don't like to grow, because, you know.
And you have to have a new economy.
Yeah. And at that time, most of those folks up there were just trying to stay alive. Mm-hmm. They weren't trying to grow rice to sell to Thailand to get money to buy a radio. They could go down and barter in Vientiane and get a radio. That was probably the biggest project, was the rice growing project. And they also had a cooperative farm over in a valley near Longchang, where they had a big swine production project. Mm-hmm. That was primarily USAID that was involved with that. And I would go over there and work there a couple of days a week once I got clearance to get over there. Mm-hmm. That was a fairly good-sized operation, and there were a lot of farmers involved in that. Mm-hmm. Primarily swine production. I think they had some cows. They had chickens, geese. The biggest part was swine production. Mm-hmm. And they had both USAID veterinarians that were working there, and they had locals that had been trained as veterinarians. Putong to Longchang, the road was 5 miles long. But it was through a couple of streams, big streams, up and down over roads, around curves. It took over an hour to get that far. You could hop in a plane, you'd be there in 5 minutes, just up the top of the hill and over the hill, land. I worked over there quite a bit. And I also, we would have different projects out in the different villages. So I spent part of my time going out and did quite a bit of overnight, where we would get dropped off in one village.
By air?
By air. And I did a lot of flying up there. I have a log in there of everything it was, and I'm real AR when it comes to numbers. I keep all this stuff.
Remember that. But you would know.
So some of those times were interesting when you would get dropped off in a village with your interpreter and know that you were going to be there that day and overnight and weren't going to get picked up till the next afternoon. They were pretty careful as to whether there were bad guys in the area. And we usually worked south of Sam Tong, which was much more secure. We didn't do much work north because it was real shaky up there. But still, when you'd get dropped off in the afternoon, all you got is your pack on your back and a little bit of food and stuff, and that plane disappears over the hill, and you know you're not going to see it till 24 hours or so later. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, you know, you got to trust somebody. And some of the foods were real interesting. Always had sticky rice.
Yes. Okay, hold on one second. Okay, thanks.
We're back. We were talking about some of the food you had in the villages.
Well, you always had sticky rice. They always had a big pot of that, and they would usually fix it the day before and put it in little bamboo baskets. And so you got used to cold sticky rice and grab it out and roll it into a ball. And then they would also have what they call lau lau, which is a rice wine. Mm-hmm. Very potent. It'll burn with a blue flame. It's very, I don't know what percentage, but it's strong. Well, lau hai, which is rice, almost like a beer. It's a lower grade, but lau lau is potent stuff. Mm-hmm. But so you could always figure that there would be sticky rice. The evening meal.
You won't believe this. We have to stop for a second. So we were talking about food, sticky rice, and lau lau.
So one time, okay, so we always had the sticky rice and then different drinks to go with it, but the main things were the lau lau and the lau hai. One time I got two food stories that are interesting. One time we were out in this village, and we were quite a ways out,